I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's been a year since Kansas City voters approved a unique 1/8-cent sales tax. Unique because while the money is collected throughout town, it is only to be spent in a confined area from 9th Street to Gregory Boulevard and between Indiana and the Paseo. Today we'll check in on what's happening with those funds and the tax board that controls how they're spent. After that, just because your teen's Facebook page is free from untoward behavior doesn't mean they're not engaging in it. We'll learn about Finstagram and other ways online life is impacting teen sexuality. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In April 2017, Kansas City voters approved a 1/8-cent sales tax increase to be used solely for economic development on Kansas City's east side. It was something of a surprising vote, based as it was on the idea that the tax would be focused in just one part of the community. Still, it passed with 52% support. Now it's time for an update. What will the approximately $10 million a year that the tax will generate be used for? What projects are in the pipeline? Here to give us an update is Herb Hardwick. He's an attorney and chairman of the Central City Economic Development Sales Tax Board that's overseeing the distribution of this money. Herb, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Great, Steve. Thank you for having me.
There's an ongoing, there's an enormous amount of need on the city's east side, Herb, and I'm just guessing that sorting out all the priorities, all the needs, is easier said than done here.
Absolutely. Over the past 7 or 8 months since the board was constituted, we've been working diligently to put in a framework from an administrative standpoint and from a policy standpoint to come up with a mechanism or a platform for evaluating proposals that we can utilize to fund projects that are being considered by various stakeholders who are bringing those forth.
I'm guessing, what, you have hundreds of ideas have been put forth? Is that fair to say?
Well, I would say
thousands.
Many ideas have come forward, a wide spectrum of ideas, everything from jobs, new businesses, traditional development, rehab, social programs. So there has been many comments, many ideas as to what these funds could be utilized for.
You know, $8 or $10 million a year sounds like a lot of money, but based on my own experience covering Kansas City, Kansas, where that community recently got a $12 million a year windfall, I began to understand that in a large community, $8 million or $10 million a year still, as it's sort of hard to believe, but it isn't all that much.
It's a start, Steve.
Yeah.
Given what has occurred on the east side for many years, where you've had developers and entrepreneurs who have had access to capital, the $10 million is a good start. And remember, it's $10 million over 10 years, so it's $100 million. Our job is to figure out how to leverage those funds and hopefully convert that $100 million to something which would be a multiple if we're doing our job correctly and if the opportunities come forward that we think may come.
And say that last part again. You hope to sort of multiply this money somehow?
Yeah, from the standpoint, if we are successful and as developers come forward and as they establish and build and construct projects, that we should be able to take that $10 million a year and invest it in such a way that it's going to create a greater leverage on assets.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing that, you, at the end of the day, 10 years from now, 7 years from now, there's going to be more economic stimulus and revitalization in the district.
Is that because you hope that the folks who benefit from the tax can ultimately repay some of it, Herb? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, that's a good point. We're hoping that some of the monies will be utilized for grants and some of the monies will be utilized for loans. We would hope to recoup some of those monies so that they can be recycled back into other projects on an ongoing basis. Obviously, if you have an experienced developer who has the moxie to make a project go, there may be a greater likelihood that he or she may be able to generate a return or a profit and still repay some of the money back.
Hey, and just to be clear, have you spent any of the money yet?
We have not spent not $1, Steve. To date, the fiscal year for 2017 just ended. We had generated about $4.5 million. And coming forward through July 5th, we have another $1.5 million or so. We have roughly $5.7 million available. And you may be aware of this, that on June 1st, we let our application request for proposals. The funding cycle goes from June 1 through August 2nd. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping as applications come in, we will begin to evaluate those and then hopefully make recommendations to the council, be in a position to make recommendations to the council in August.
This coming August, just
Correct.
A month from now.
Correct.
Yeah. There was some concern as a member of the editorial board of the Star. We editorialized a few weeks ago about this idea that, hey, this tax was approved in April of 2017, but you guys were just asking for proposals in recent weeks. What took so long?
Well, our board was not constituted until October of 2017. So the various governmental entities, they had to make a determination as to who they were going to select. For the city of Kansas City, Missouri, they selected myself, Donna Wilson, and Keith Brown.
Right.
Kansas City School District selected Mr. Ron Finley. And Jackson County appointed Dr. Melissa Patterson Hasley. So we started in October, Steve, and for the past 7 or 8 months, we've held maybe 16, 17 meetings,
wow.
which have been meetings for admin, meetings for public hearings, strategic planning. So it's one of those things that this is new. There was no infrastructure. There was no roadmap per se. And we believe that it's better to be thoughtful and reflective to come up with a good process. Because if we come up with a bad process and we make bad decisions, I think that we're going to hear from a lot of people.
Yeah. Just from talking to people, I've come across this notion that you guys don't want to blow this. This is a tremendous opportunity and you want to get it right.
We absolutely want to get it right. It's ironic that all five directors who sit on the board are residents or citizens of Kansas City, Missouri, of the urban core. We grew up in the urban core. We are part and parcel of the urban core. We recognize that this is a profound opportunity. We are thankful to the citizens of Kansas City, Missouri, for being so forward-thinking with respect to creating an opportunity such as this. So we absolutely want it to be a springboard for greater opportunities in the future.
This was a little unusual. Looking back at the original vote in April of 2017, Herb, the mayor, Sly James, the city manager, Troy Schulte, both came out against this idea. Their concern was that, hey, we don't know how this money is going to be spent. And yet, the voters with 52% backing still approved this thing. You don't see that happen really often. So maybe that adds a little bit to the pressure that you all face to lay this thing out correctly.
Yes, we believe that we are fiduciaries of this money. We want to be careful and smart by how it's used. And at the end of the day, we want to demonstrate to the citizens of Kansas City that we're good stewards of these monies and that these monies can, in fact, be utilized in such a way to enhance a very important part of the city, which has not received the attention that it should have for a number of years. Haven't had access to the economic development tools that many parts of the city have had by the utilization of developers.
Herb Hardwick is my guest. He's the chairman of the board overseeing the distribution of the proceeds of the 1/8-cent sales tax that voters in Kansas City approved in April of 2017 for the East Side. How big of a difference ultimately do you think this money's going to make?
Well,
put it in perspective for us.
Well, I think if we're able to create an environment where you've seen many areas experience redevelopment, Crossroads, downtown Kansas City, further south Kansas City, up north development is occurring. If we are able to use this as a jump start, these dollars could be transformative. Everyone is holding their breath and watching truth transformed before our eyes. Mm-hmm. And it is like a renaissance. It's wonderful.
Startling. Yeah.
Startling. So if that can carry over into the Central City sales tax district,
right,
that would be phenomenal.
But the challenge still remains, if only because the spending power on the east side is so much less than it is in other parts of the community. That makes it tough, doesn't it, still, even with this money?
Oh, it certainly makes it tough. The median income for citizens that live in the district is roughly $24,000. It's almost half of what the median income is for other residents in Kansas City, Missouri. So that tells you that there's a significant disparity. But I think, again, what you're seeing on the east side is that you're starting to see young people move back into the central city. They're rehabbing houses because right now they can buy them at good pricing and put the money in. The transportation costs are lower. We all know that millennials, if they can opt out of not buying a car, they will, and they'll use public transportation. So while it's tough and while there's a disparity, I think if we're systematic and forward thinking, I think it can happen. The other thing that must happen, Steve, is that there must be buy-in from other organizations that are utilizing, that have targeted and have resources that could be channeled toward this part of the city. We've heard from many entities, including the EDC of Kansas City, Missouri, the KCATA, Parks and Rec. They are expressing an interest to come in and join this initiative to help revitalize and stimulate this part of the city. So if there is a collaborative approach that we can come up with that can bring more dollars, more development to this part of the city, then that would be a win-win for everyone.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. We're talking about redevelopment of the east side using that 1-8 cent sales tax increase that voters approved last year. 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So Herb, just generally then, what is the process you're using to sort through ideas, to sort through proposals, and begin to chart a path forward here?
Yeah, that's a great question because it's kind of like we're kind of feeling our way through the dark here.
Yeah.
What we're doing is we've sent out a request for proposal. And so we basically have said we've established a pretty broad parameters for what we want to see. So we went with a request for proposal. So that gives everyone, if you will,
an
opportunity to submit experienced developers, new developers, not-for-profits, social agencies, so on and so forth. Now, at the same time, we do have our priorities, and it's reflected in our application and a strategic plan that we've been working on. So we're looking for economic development, commercial, industrial, residential. We're looking for catalytic projects. We're looking for projects that if existing development is already in progress, how can we synergize or leverage funds to help enhance that particular project? Mm-hmm. So there are things that we're looking for, but we want these requests for proposals to come in. We're going to evaluate them. We're going to look for projects that are, if you will, viable, that have a really good chance for success.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a process where people submit an application, and because they submit an application, they're entitled to money. It doesn't work that way. As I mentioned earlier, as we look upon ourselves as fiduciaries, we're looking to make sure that the money is invested in a way that's responsible, that there's a return on investment. And if there are, and I'm sure there will be, entities, agencies, individuals who may be first-time applicants for monies of this type, we're hoping to have perhaps if they're not in a position where we can fund them, that we can perhaps point them in a direction or help identify other resources that may assist them so that they can get to a point where they can participate in these funds and others.
And again, you hope to begin making decisions on disbursements even as early as next month.
Yes,
yeah.
It would be ideal. Of course, as you mentioned, in your editorial in the Kansas City Star, that while we had approval back in April of 2017, the process has taken some time. So we are as anxious to get the process moving and getting money on the street But again, we want to be cautious, methodical, and intentional about how we do this.
You know, if people listening want to get some sense of the challenges over on the east side, the editorial board, as this tax was being debated back in the spring of 2017, we all hopped on a bus and took a ride down Prospect Avenue. It'll take your breath away in terms of the needs that are out there. And very quickly, you get a sense of the challenges facing the east side and the challenges facing your board, frankly.
Yes.
It's breathtaking.
It is. It's more than a notion. The funds that have been entrusted to us, I should note that 20% of the funds must be used for infrastructure. 20%. There's a mandate. So all those monies that come through, if it's a $10 million pot, $2 million will be dedicated to infrastructure. The other 80% can be utilized for anything, if you will, that concerns or touches economic development. Mm-hmm. We'll have a focus in terms of how the monies will be utilized based upon the applications that come in. But it is a significant task. I am very happy to be working with the four professionals that I'm working with. They're very dedicated, committed, insightful. I think we've had near perfect attendance at our 16 or 17 meetings, Steve. And so there's a high degree of energy that is being focused here by this group. And as we go through the community and talk, interface with stakeholders, leaders about how these monies should be utilized.
I was going to say, when you have these public meetings, Herb, what kind of attendance do you have from the public showing up at these things?
Great question. We had structured our schedule. If we're going to have an administrative meeting, we have been holding those in the morning, midday. But we also had several meetings that we held in the evenings. And when we had those meetings, it was not unusual to see 20, 25, 30 people or more mm-hmm. who come in. And not only did they want to hear what we had to say, they had ideas, thoughts, and comments about things that they thought were important. And I thought it was important for the board members to hear that so that we can have a good sense for the community's expectations for how these monies could possibly be utilized.
You know, do you have concerns that the community on the east side is almost over-expecting here? They hear this notion of $8 million, $10 million a year, over a decade, $100 million, and pretty soon you can get visions of Christmas in your mind that this is, you know, going to be a whole new day for the east side. Is that the case?
I'm not sure that that's the case. You have developers who are very experienced and have been involved in this process for a number of years, starting projects, sustaining projects. I think they understand that this is a long, arduous process in terms of bringing a project to fruition. So I don't think that segment of the population has expectations that are not realistic. You may have community members who may have some expectations, but I think their attitude has been wait and see. Mm-hmm. Let's see how this works out. Let's see what we can do. How can we participate? So I think there's been a healthy skepticism whether or not these dollars will really come to the table and if they can be translated and if they can be accessible to folk who are everyday people trying to make a difference.
Yeah. You've also set some rules for how the money cannot be spent. What have you pinpointed there, Herb, in terms of where this money will not be going?
Great question. First, I should say that our board does not have access to these funds. We do not have a budget. Everything is controlled by the city council. So no dollars come to us. We're not compensated for our work here. So I think that should be clarified.
And your recommendations will be forwarded to the council, which will have to sign off on anything you do. So there's a double layer of check and balance here.
Yeah, so we want the public to understand that, yes, we sit on this board, but in terms of being able to actually direct, no, we can make a recommendation.
Right.
One of the areas that's kind of ironic that you cannot utilize the monies for is for retail development. And some people were really surprised by that. You cannot use it for vertical retail development.
Because?
Well, I think the reason, A, is prohibited by the ordinance.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of exceptions. A, if it is being used for a public purpose, for example, if it's a city-owned facility, take the Linwood Shopping Center, for example, that is retail, but the city owns it. But arguably, the city got involved,
right,
engaged for public perfect economic development in this case, to bring goods and services and create jobs. So in that case, you have that narrow exception. The other exception is if it's located in a historic district. So if it's located in a historic district, then that is also another exception. There are only two historic districts that we are aware of. One is 18th and Vine,
mm-hmm,
and one is the Santa Fe district.
Right. Okay. So decisions coming next month, and we'll be seeing you guys in the news a little bit a few weeks from now then.
Yes, hopefully with some good recommendations that are supported by the council, Steve.
Okay.
Okay.
That's Herb Hardwick. He's an attorney. He's chairman of the Central City Economic Development Sales Tax Board that's overseeing the distribution of this 1/8 cent sales tax increase. Herb, thanks for coming in. Appreciate the update very much. Good luck in your deliberations.
Thank you so much, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about teens using social media in new ways when it comes to expressing their sexuality. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the show, we talked to local law enforcement about the protocols they follow to de-escalate dangerous and potentially violent situations. You can find out more. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. If you're looking to fill out your summer reading list, join us tomorrow. Author Whitney Terrell and writer Prentice Patience Randall recommend novels and nonfiction for you to check out. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, social media has given everyone with an internet connection the ability to get their message out to the world. As early adopters, teens are usually at the forefront of social media trends, for good or ill. Lately, that's meant a shift away from broad public disclosures like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram toward very private, limited networks of closer friends. While that may seem great, it's creating an entire world of teen activity screened off from outsiders, and that includes parents. And you may not be surprised to learn that a fair amount of what goes back and forth on between teens includes sexual expression. Here to discuss this trend is Wes Crenshaw. He's a Lawrence psychologist. He's currently completing the first two of four books on consent-based sex education. Book two goes into depth examining how online life has impacted teen sexuality. Wes, good to have you.
Good to see you, Steve.
Nicole Ahn is the co-author of Wes' latest books. She conducted a lot of the research and interviews for the books. Nicole, welcome back to you. Nice to have you.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Well, Wes, give us a brief history here of how we got to where we are today in terms of teen social media.
Yeah, when I was writing this up, I realized how not brief it is, but I'll give you the concise version.
Yeah.
So about the first 30 seconds that we had cameras attached to phones, kids began taking pictures of themselves in intimate poses and styles and sending them to other people. And there have been, I think it's very easy. When I look back at some of my old newspaper columns, I sounded almost hysterical about this because it's very easy to become kind of freaked out about this idea. But as it has evolved and become more ubiquitous than you can even imagine, these different platforms have formed that allow kids to share a lot of intimacy, whether that is emotional intimacy or sexual intimacy or visual intimacy. And some parents, I think, don't even yet realize that we've gone from a kind of open Facebook world to a very private, what's called Finstagram world, where people have just a very closed network where they share a lot of these things.
Let's talk a little more about Finstagram, Nicole. You're the resident teen here on our panel today. It's probably best to ask you, what in the world is Finstagram?
So Finstagram is a combination of words fake and Instagram. So it's a fake Instagram where you post pictures of things that you would really post on your main account, which is your Rinstagram which is real Instagram.
They have language for everything.
Yeah. Wow. So pictures of like you going to parties in the summer or like a funny sleepover or like a funny picture that you want to post that you really wouldn't want to post on your main Instagram for your colleges and jobs to see. That's where we post our pictures.
Oh, so that's the origin of this. We've heard and we've talked on this show any number of times about, hey, we're cautioning young people as to what they put on social media because maybe someday their employers might see it. Mm-hmm. And you're saying this new idea of Finstagram is the answer to that, which is a closed-off Instagram account only available to a few immediate friends.
Yeah, we found a way to like actually have fun on social media without the responsibilities of being a responsible adult.
And this has evolved exactly as you're describing it. We have warned kids for years, you're creating this digital footprint. And I think we thought, well, kids will, you know, stop doing this. Well, of course, they're not going to, but they actually become very sophisticated about protecting it. You may remember years ago we did a show on Twitter, and one of the things I pointed out there was that how upset teenagers were that their teacher would see them on Twitter. Well, that's the point of Twitter.
Yeah.
And so that's why a lot of teenagers aren't really doing a lot of expression on Twitter anymore, is they've learned that they have to create closed networks.
So, Nicole, teens then have these closed accounts, this notion of Finstagram again. Mm-hmm. Can I ask, like, how many people do you have on your Finstagram account? When you do this, how many people are seeing your messages?
Well, for mine, since my Instagram is kind of casual and it doesn't have any explicit content, I allow it to go up to like 95, 96 followers.
Oh, okay.
Compared to Wes's opinion where he thinks that I should only have like 6 followers.
This was a breakfast discussion today. So the other thing though is there's different levels of this. Like one of the things Nicole was talking about with me today is that she has 2 levels of Finsta. So you have your regular Instagram that, you know, your colleges and your parents and all this see, mm-hmm. and you post your, you know, how beautiful you are and smart every day. And then you have your Finsta, which is your, maybe in her case, 90. Most of the kids I see, it's 50 or 60. But Nicole is particularly interesting. Where you kind of share your private thoughts and your private pictures that you just want 90 people to know. Then many have these, what are be like a sub-Finsta or what Nicole calls a Finsta-Finsta, which is like 5 people.
Wow.
And I see this quite a bit. I think Nicole just shares her deepest thoughts and poetry on hers. I am not a member, however, of hers. But for quite a few people, this is where teenagers are posting their more sexually explicit material, including nudes, which can mean literally nude, or it can mean bikini shots or partially nude shots. And that's in a tiny group of 5 or 6 people. And how this has evolved of late is it's become the symbol of body positivity. So I have just last week had a 18-year-old who's done this for a couple of years who said to me, and I quote, she told me I could quote her, the best thing I ever did was to open this Insta Nudes Finsta, where I have gotten so much positive feedback about myself and my sexuality from my friends. So this idea I had way back in 2004 that digital photography would allow kids to kind of explore themselves in a way that they couldn't before and become more – have a better, healthier view of their body finally now is beginning to emerge. And with it, though, comes, you know, some of those security issues we always worry about. But that's where these super Finstas come into play in terms of posting of nudity.
You know, this is so interesting to me because, Nicole, when we first broached this topic and I was looking at it last night and reading about this, my first impulse was this new development with Finstagram and this closed network of followers on Instagram for young people was going to be a bad thing, mm-hmm. that you're posting naughty pictures or whatever, and this was going to be lead to all kinds of issues. But what Wes said just sort of flips that upside down for me. To what extent, in your experience, has all of this been positive as opposed to something a lot more nefarious?
Definitely. I've had a lot of friends who made those sub-Finsta accounts or Finsta-Finsta accounts that multiply told me that making those accounts were the best choices of their entire lives, because it's like having a personal secret diary, but online. Mm-hmm. And it's also like a secret photo album from your family members and university admissions officers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a healthy way to express your life in a more intimate level.
I was going to say, I mean, is it healthy to take pictures, nude pictures of yourself or nearly nude pictures, and share those with others? Again, for my generation, that you're talking Arabic here. That is completely foreign. Well, of course, we didn't have cell phones back then, but this is a whole different dynamic here, Wes.
You said it. So one of the things Nicole did, Nicole has been an incredible asset in the work on these books, because she can go out and do focus groups and interviews with teenagers. She is the dream partner in this.
Because she's a teen herself.
Yeah, and she's also really good at interviewing people. And so one of the things I sent her out to do was to ask people about the sort of the evolution of nudity, the idea of nudity. I had a suspicion I knew where this was headed, and her interviews really confirmed. Over the last 10 years, in part because of digital photography and in part because of pornography, which we've talked about many times here, kids are no longer sensitive to this idea of being nude. Now, I'm not saying they're all going to show up in, you know, class tomorrow nude, but to the idea of seeing each other's bodies without clothes on is not that big a deal anymore. And this is a huge change. Because,
well, where did this come from?
Well, it came from, it is what psychologists refer to as systematic desensitization. Now, I'm going to propose for a moment, because we have such a hang-up about nudity in our society, I'm going to propose we sort of look at this value neutral for a second. Because what kids have done is to see so much nudity in their lives, online and in their bedroom and in their own pictures, that this is
on their phones. You're talking about,
yeah, you bet.
Pornography is instantly available, and that's what we all of us parents fear all the time.
And what we haven't yet talked about, but will, they do Snapchat each other pictures in various states of undress. I will say for Nicole, on her behalf, she writes a little piece in the book about that she does not do that. Nicole is in the minority. Most teenagers I work with estimate that between 70 and 85% of their peer group regularly send pictures back and forth in some state of undress.
Let me just ask Nicole, does that sound right to you, what Wes just said, that the vast majority of young people are doing that these days?
Yeah, the desensitization is definitely happening. I experienced it myself. Growing up in a generation that always had like access to technology, I always had access to like porn websites if I wanted to, and I could see pictures of people who are naked all the time. So whenever I see someone who is naked on my Finsta feed, I am not that surprised. Even though we still have that guideline within the Finsta community that we will not share any of the contents that are on our feed without their permission.
And that's, don't these that's photographs very important. On Instagram, they don't last a long time. Don't they disappear at some point?
That's Snapchat.
And that, this is a different deal.
Yeah, Finstagram will stay there as long as they want. But Nicole, I don't want to let go of something Nicole just said that's crucially, vitally important. So for parents, what we want the message for parents to hear is not panic.
there's some parents listening to this out there who are panicked right now. Yeah.
But our model is always pause, listen, understand, and be sex positive. And if you do not enter a dialogue with your kids about all these topics we're talking about, then they're just going to go do them without you being involved. So one of the things that she said that's very important, that's why the books are called Consent-Based Sex Education, is in the Finsta group she has, and in all the Finsta groups I know of that are those the ones that do share nudes, to post something nude without the understanding of the group and the permission of the group is forbidden. It is within that ethos, bad manners. So this we see in Snapchat world, boys love to send pictures of their penis. They think that's super neat, like a peacock or something showing its feathers. And that's not actually considered good etiquette. So tell your kids not to do that.
But Nicole, we're sitting here talking about etiquette. It seems to me the risk someone might be taking by sending electronically a photo of themselves, either nude or mostly nude, that's still pretty risky, isn't it? I mean, you worry about your social media accounts being seen by employers someday. What about a photo of somebody undressed flashing around the internet?
It is pretty risky, but I think that's how much we need, that tells us how much we need sex education within family environments, because if your parents were sex positive and you were raised to value your body, then you will definitely know how to handle those situations when you're like wanting to send a nude picture to someone or post it on your Finstuff Instagram.
And the motivation here, I still want to get back to the motivation for doing this. It sounds like for a lot of kids, it's to get positive feedback. Mm-hmm. Are there other motivations here? I mean, Wes sort of just talked about boys wanting to strut their stuff. I can get that. But why else?
Well, personally, I have not encountered any other situations where people had different intentions in their nude posts. But mm-hmm. most of the times it's for body positivity or self-love.
And I have...
Hang on, let me get our phone number out for parents out there who are concerned and want to call in and perhaps ask a few questions here about this big development in our culture. 816-235-2888 is the phone number. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Wes, I cut you off.
I absolutely have had other experiences of this. There are kids, both male and female, who use the distribution of their nudes as a sort of, popularity enhancer. In the book, I also did some interviews with kids who practice exchange of nudes, and they were unbelievably insightful about the dynamics surrounding this. And there are several very negative ones. One is if you exchange with a partner, which is very common, it's part of the dating practice at this point. If you exchange with a partner and the relationship goes south, which is 100% of the time in adolescence, then there can be situations of extortion, where the person says, well, if you don't stay with me, I'm going to expose your nudes. I have an example where the ex new girlfriend of one of the partners threatens the old partner, if you don't stay away from him, I'm going to expose your nudes. So there's an example of a concerning dynamic with these kind of things that kids need to talk to kids about that. You need to say, be aware of how this can come back on you.
You know, we're really sitting here in this day and age. We've talked on this show, again, any number of times about cell phones and the unintended consequences of those phones and the uncertainty around what those phones are doing to our kids. Well, it strikes me that, well, the chickens have come home to roost here, that now we're sitting here talking about this topic.
Yes.
This is precisely one of those areas that we're having to navigate on the fly as our young people go out into the world and are partaking in this practice.
I could not have said that better myself. You
can use that in your book.
I will probably do that. Believe me, you're in there.
Yeah.
So we have talked for years and been very much ahead of the curve on this show about where this was headed. And I think what's changed for me that I'm less hysterical than I used to be about it is hearing how kids are talking about it, and it's reassuring that when they see an extortion plot against them, they adjust their behavior. Now, there are other people who, as I said, are using nudes as a ticket for popularity. There's always that girl, usually, who is highly desired, almost like a baseball card, that, you know, you want that baseball card.
Wow.
And that's the picture you want to get. Now, I think I'm not going to judge that person or the many of them for that decision, but I think parents better be in the conversation to be talking about what's happening. in a dynamic where nudes become a method of building popularity.
Well, let's talk about the role of parents here in just a moment. Just to clear up a couple things here. Okay. Daniel from Kansas City, Missouri has written to ask, aren't kids, Nicole, concerned about hackers, much like what happened to Ashley Madison's website a few years ago?
So there probably isn't a way to prevent hackers from our Finsta accounts.
There's no way to prevent it, you're saying?
Well, yeah, as much as you can't prevent your own main account hacking. So the best way is to just keep it secure as possible and only let the people that you trust follow your Finstas.
And I would point out, it's an interesting comparison. I would have pointed out Jennifer Lawrence as the person who had the mega hack of her iCloud. She absolutely did nothing wrong. She didn't send those pictures to anyone. Right. She's written and spoken articulately about this as a form of sex offense. I think follow that conversation with Jennifer Lawrence. I think she's had some good things to say about it. The Ashley Madison thing is a little bit different because, first of all, that was a fake system. There weren't even real people on there. All the women on Ashley Madison, all the straight women were robots. That was completely a scam. Mm-hmm. So when people got caught, they were being caught cheating on their partner with a robot. In this case, kids, honestly, I don't want to overstate this, but I have had 100 conversations with kids about this. And the attitude, if your nudes get out, is that's kind of immature that he shared my picture with somebody. What a man boy. Or what? You know, that's the attitude. It isn't like my life is over.
It's not like my life is over.
It used to be. It's not anymore.
816-235-2888. We're talking with Dr. Wes Crenshaw and Nicole Ahn today about sort of the use of social media to spread provocative pictures of young people and what that means for them, what it means for our culture. 816-235-2888 is the number. Dave from Independence, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. What I'd like to know is now, where's the boundary between nudity and pornography? If you're doing nudes on the cell phone, where's the boundary?
Yep, good question. So,
Nicole, where is the boundary? Is there a boundary?
I would define it as what it was intended for.
Right.
A nude picture can be meant for like workout progresses or how your body's changing or how much you appreciate your body. And if it was taken to do that kind of jobs for yourself, then I don't think it should be defined as a pornography.
But if we've come this far, isn't just the logical next step for couples who are newly dating to begin showing pictures of themselves engaging in goodness knows what?
Happens a lot.
It happens a lot. We've already crossed
the line. I can go on a lot of stories. I was telling Nicole one today about horrified her at breakfast. Dave's point is well taken, and so is Nicole's. The intent of the picture when you hit snap it may be different than what it becomes used for. At one point 5 years ago, and I'm sure the number is higher now, a third of all child pornography defined as persons under the age of consent in nude photos. A third of it was made the way we are talking about today. And I make that point in the book. I compare this sort of body positive thing with this other dark web version. So, a young person may be very pleased with their picture. It may be very healthy and fit and non-sexually provocative. And someone who's into child pornography is going to think that was a score if it ever gets to them. So yes, this is a concern.
So I guess the big question then as we begin to move towards the end of the segment is what on earth are parents to do about this? How should they be responding, Wes?
Well, like I said earlier, panic is the last thing you should do. We have some really good interviews in the book where parents panicked or tried to cut off the service or monitor the child's moment to moment, and that tripled the child's interest in getting it done. And there's some pretty disturbing stuff in the second book, things that make me blanch about kids who were in non-dialogical relationships with parents who just went off rogue and became involved in a lot of online things. And these are not kids from, Chicago. These are kids from our land. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. parents must be understand the material, understand the discussions we're having today, and understand the current real dynamic, and then be engaged in a discussion with your kids consistently.
Nicole, as you talk to kids for the book about this, what did you come across in terms of kids saying they've had positive experiences with their parents about how to navigate this new set of shoals, rocks on the beach here? What came through in those interviews?
Many of my friends told me that externalizing their struggles or like their thoughts on an account or a picture that they post has helped them conceptualize their ideas and actually talk about it with their parents and get help through that. Mm. And instead of like just sitting around on your desk and thinking about your problems, like externalizing it and writing it down and posting a picture about it will actually help them think more about it and come to a discussion about their parents.
Do many of your friends, do they have good relationships with their parents? Can they have dialogue about these issues, or do you find that most kids simply don't?
Well, I have friends who have kind of difficult relationships with their parents, yet ever since they started to post things on their Instagram and be socially active and be active about their emotions, they've definitely got some help from their parents and started to talk more to authorities about it.
And I have illustrations of all possibilities. I have the ones where the parent bucks and the child goes rogue. I have one where the child has a Finsta and the parent is aware of that and converses with her about the wisdom of that and how to proceed, and that goes much better. So it's all over the range, and the dialogue is clearly what's valuable.
The consent-based sex education book that you're talking about, it's not out yet, but parents can still engage and kids can still engage. Just quickly, how, Wes?
Book one is in book form. Book two is about to go out. That's the one that contains all this material, and we are actively working with focus groups and parents. Church of the Resurrection is helping us with that. If people want to get involved in an early read, I'll get them a free copy in exchange for them giving us their thoughts and reviews and panic or whatever they want to feed back to us.
That's Dr. Wes Crenshaw, Lawrence psychologist. This morning he was joined by Nicole Ahn, a co-author of Wes's latest books. Thank you both for an enlightening conversation and maybe for scaring the heck out of a lot of parents out there. But
we hope they can work through it in peace.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you both.
Thanks,
Steve.
Okay, tomorrow on the show we'll find out what should be on your summer reading list. Our book critics give us their current favorites in fiction and nonfiction, and we'll hear about classics they think you should revisit. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.